Thought I'd talk a little bit about empathy this evening. I'm sure some of you will be aware that there's a blockbuster film come out. And the Church of England had commissioned an advert to be played before the film, where various people recite the Lord's Prayer. And the cinemas refused to play. This caused a certain amount of furore and variance of opinion. And in part, I felt, well, that's really sad, you know. You pay your money, you go and sit down, and you've paid to be blasted with all these adverts telling you to buy, buy, buy. Consumerism leads to happiness. And yet there's so much suffering in the world, and no one seems to be terribly happy, even though they got all that stuff. And here is a prayer, for want of a better word. And this isn't to talk about Christianity, but what I wanted to point out was that there is an underlying structure that is very, very similar to what Buddhism talks about. I mean, essentially, it's what's that particular prayer talking about? It's talking about perhaps recognizing that life will give you what you need, as long as you're content with what you receive, that's fine, but life will look after you. It's saying that do to others as you would wish to be done to yourself, that it's a good thing to accept other people's misdemeanors. They can't help it, they're learning just as we are, and likewise, you know, we make mistakes too. This all sounds very familiar, doesn't it? And I thought very poignantly that actually there is something beyond the appearance of things. And that though, yes, we do indeed fill up our lives with the froth and trinkets of life, really there is something more important going on that we're all involved with. And so in one sense, I felt, well, it would have been good. It would have been nice for people to see it, to hear that. Because what struck me was that people weren't really particularly talking about the value of what's contained within that particular message. It was whether or not that message should be allowed to be stated. There is another counterpoint to this, which somebody pointed out very recently to me, which was that if you allow a message from one particular religion to be played this year, there'll be calls for a message from another religion to be played next year. And then you've got this whole problem of people being offended by this lot but not that lot, being offended by that lot but not this lot. And it did seem to make sense that, well, actually, sad as it is, you can't allow that really to happen. What a shame. Wouldn't it be nice if sort of all the other religions sort of said, well, he's kind of making the point for all of us there. It's the same underlying structure, so you know, fair enough, go ahead. That's fine by us. But it doesn't work like that. And the problem is, of course, attachment to views. Attachment to views prevents empathy. It prevents the ability to be able to see things from another point of view. Views of all kinds are the outcome of ignorance. If you know how life is, you don't have to have a belief about how it is because you know and you understand. So beliefs, views, all come out of an ignorance of life. And they are intended to give some solidity to that sense of self that people have. So I am me and these are my views and that proves that I am me. So that's where the attachment comes from. And there is also a desire to be free from the inherent uncertainty in the world. The idea is that by holding strongly to a belief and having other people around me who also share that belief, I will be secure, I will be safe. So you can see why views are so important and yet how much conflict they actually create. Because if something is born of conflict, it merely creates further conflict. It creates further division. There's another example of this that I saw on TV, a documentary, I don't know if you saw it, about race relations in the US. And there was this particular rally being conducted somewhere in the Deep South by radical white supremacists. And of course, there was therefore a counter demonstration by all the people that opposed that particular outlook of life. And the two demonstrations kind of met. And there was a lot of scuffling and shouting and so forth. And there was this one scene that I think will remain in my memory for a very long time. There were two chaps came together, and they were nose to nose, toe to toe, looking each other in the eyes with just the most amazing vitriol and hatred. And one of them was shouting at the top of his voice, screaming, "White power, white power." And the other one was screaming at the top of his voice, "Black power, black power." And they were just screaming at each other, holding their fists aloft, screaming, "White power, black power, white power, black power." And it just carried on. It just carried on. And I was there looking at it and going, gee, I think this distills the whole problem of these in one, because it was just one complete whole. There was no division, no separation anywhere other than in those people's minds. They created boxes for themselves to exist in. And they couldn't see that the underlying structure of how they got there and doing that to one another was exactly the same for both of them. They were brothers. They were just completely the same. The whole processes of clinging attachment that led them to that point were exactly the same for both. Oh, irony. But of course they couldn't see it at all. They could not see the deep paradox of, oh, maybe they did. Maybe after they stopped filming, they suddenly went, oh, do you know what we're doing? I bet they didn't, though. So, views. So when it comes to Buddhism, what we have to realise is that Buddhism is non-partisan. There's no political aspect to Buddhism at all. How could there be? Because politics of all kinds also stems from ignorance. The role of the Buddha's teaching is to show us the underlying structure that gives rise to views in the first place, that gives rise to conflict, that gives rise to passionate resistance. So how can Buddhism say it's on these people's side or this people's side? Because really, they're both the same, essentially, because the underlying structures that give rise to them are the same. There's a wonderful example of this which demonstrates the Buddha's incredible skills at diplomacy in a sutta in the Pali Canon. You have to understand that the Buddha was an itinerant teacher, so he moved from place to place around the Ganges plain in India. There were different principalities, different clans, different societies. One of them was called Magadha, and there was a king of Magadha called Ajatasattu. The Buddha taught in his kingdom. He also taught the Vijayan clan, which was another principality. And King Ajatasattu had got it into his head that he wanted to destroy the Vijayan clan completely. You know how leaders do from time to time? They get it into their heads that, oh, maybe that will make me happy. Power obviously clearly completely went to his head. But he had enough wherewithal. He decided that he couldn't attack the Vijayan clan until he knew that he would be successful. And he thought the best way of finding out would be to get his prime minister to go and see the Buddha and get the Buddha to predict the outcome, whether he would win or not. So you can see the difficulty that the Buddha's in, because he teaches in both principalities, he teaches all people. He doesn't pick and choose in that way. And so he's being asked by the king to get involved in the political arena. And this is the way that he got round the problem. He was very diplomatic. And it's a display of his understanding, of again, of these underlying structures at work. So rather than saying yes or no, these people would win and these people would lose, he said to this Prime Minister, he said, if there are seven conditions that the Fijian people are holding to and keeping to, then their prosperity is to be expected, not their decline. A very interesting way of putting it. And they are, the first one was that the clan hold regular meetings, like councils, to sort out the problems of their society and, you know, get things done. The second was that when they meet in accord. They arise at the end of the meeting in accord, and that they go about their activities based on what they've decided in accord. They keep to the tried and tested traditions that they've had, which they know are successful in terms of keeping the wheels of their society nicely oiled. They honour and revere their elders, because the elders of their society obviously have a wealth of knowledge and understanding and experience. The women and children, I don't know what this says about societies in those days, but women and children are not abducted. They're not detained by force or mistreated. So as long as that condition is there, the prosperity of that particular principality is to be expected. And two more, which I think are very important, that they keep their religious traditions. They're generous towards the temples, their shrines, their sanghas. So always holding in mind, you know, what's really important in life. And finally, that they protect their arahants. They protect their enlightened beings. They protect their enlightened beings and they support their enlightened beings and ensure that their needs are taken account of so that they can continue to do what they do without being mistreated. So those last two are incredibly important because, again, a bit like we're saying at the beginning of the talk, it points to there being something more important than just the daily round, that life has greater and deeper significance. And that if a state, a nation, even a sangha like this, recognises that and holds that dear and holds that true, then the prosperity of that group is to be expected. As a consequence of hearing this, the Prime Minister, knowing that the Fijian people did hold to these conditions, went back to Ajatasattu and said, don't invade. But the Buddha beautifully, because he understood the underlying structure of how societies work, and this is true for any society, was able to very diplomatically point out that what was essential for prosperity. So they didn't invade, hooray. I did wonder, what would it be like if, I don't know, the Queen sent David Cameron here to ask, well, you know, should we invade Iceland? I'd be like, what? Anyway. So, empathy. Empathy comes from not being constricted by one particular view, but by understanding the underlying structures of how life works, the processes, the laws that govern how life works. So what we're engaged in here is a mindful exploration of our conscious experience as it unfolds moment by moment, in order to come to understand for ourselves what these underlying structures are. Again, shows the importance of not being tied to any one particular view about any one particular thing, but being open by being able to hold views or ideas about life which are yet untested, because that's the nature of views, isn't it? They're untested, they're assumptions, to hold them lightly in one's hand and instead place one's emphasis on that mindful exploration of life. And what happens as you do that is that you begin to experience your suffering and you start to experience and see truly what is really causing the suffering. you begin to detect the passionate resistance that always comes with feeling unhappy or feeling miserable or feeling depressed or feeling anxious or whatever it might be, whatever the suffering is. There is always that comes with it, that passionate desire for life to be different than it is. You begin to look deeply and start to observe the true nature of the true characteristics of what you're looking at. You start to detect that actually nothing endures. Despite what our perceptions have been telling us all these years, when we really start to look, we really start to detect that actually sounds, tastes, touches, smells, mental phenomena like thoughts and memories, feelings, perceptions, they share these similar characteristics. They arise and pass away due to conditions. There's nothing enduring in any of it. And one begins to recognize deeply that it's the failure to truly comprehend these true characteristics, which is the ignorance, that then gives rise to this passionate desire for life to be different. The passionate desire for life to be different then gives rise to the clinging attachment in which all these views are built up. So this wonderful process unfolds, and you have the courage and the determination and the willingness to look at the truth of your suffering and what's actually unfolding. And as you do so, and as the causes of that suffering become evident, so you begin to suffer less, inevitably. We've all got an inherent intelligence. In Buddhism, we call it wisdom. It's there, waiting. It's like it just needs to. It's like a seed that just needs to be watered. It's there, waiting, but it just needs us to look and observe. When you see truly what the problem is, you let go. It's not like you have to really contemplate whether I should let go. You just do, because you see clearly that that's what's causing the conflict. That's what's causing the pain. So you begin to suffer less. So where does the empathy come from? Well, because you're looking at truly at the processes and the orders which really govern the way life works, you detect also that these are impersonal. They're true of everyone. Conditions are impersonal. They just simply arise and pass away. And you see that that's, being that they're impersonal conditions, all these processes are true for other people too. So instead of looking at somebody and perhaps thinking, oh, they shouldn't behave like that, or why do they hold those beliefs? That's crazy. Why is that one man shouting white power and that other man shouting black power? Why are they doing that? That's ridiculous. That's crazy. Instead of that, you're able to observe the conflict. And you understand from your own experience what the true underlying structure is that gives rise to that conflict. So you have this perfect empathy. You see the suffering in others and you understand it. Now that understanding doesn't lead to conflict. That understanding actually leads to a melting of the heart. Because you understand from your own experience what it is that's required in order to let go of that clinging attachment, and you know that they can't because they don't have any understanding of those underlying structures. So true empathy comes from not from agreeing with the people with the red rosette and disagreeing with the people with the blue rosette. That's irrelevant. True empathy is understanding those underlying structures and understanding that they are indeed true for everyone. So one of the outcomes of following this way is a far deeper understanding of human life and why it is that people behave in the way that they do, and also that it just couldn't be different. That's the bit that people really struggle with. But it can't be different. Once you understand those underlying structures and you see how impersonal these processes are. It's no good shouting at the TV, oh, stop it, what are you doing? Because that's the way life's unfolding. And it's neither right nor wrong. It's not that you hold a view about it, it's just that you see that, yeah, this is the unfolding of suffering. And it's quite evident that clinging attachment due to craving for life to be different is the cause. It couldn't be different. It has to be like this. Marvellous. But you think, well, isn't that cold? Isn't that indifferent? No, that understanding leads to a melting of the heart. That's what compassion is. It's the melting of the heart. It's the recognition that if only they could get the teaching, if only had access to a teaching like this, and they had the eyes to see it, obviously, then they could come out of their suffering. But what's happening in our society? That message that there is a deeper understanding of life, that there is a way to realise that deeper understanding of life, is being dismissed in favour of oh Lord, give us today our daily bread. It's more like, oh Lord, give us our daily bread and a PlayStation, and while you're at it, a Porsche or a Mercedes-Benz. People are forgetting. People are ignoring, not wanting to contemplate the deeper realities of life. People are very much caught up with the appearance of things. But again, that's fine too. Because what happens is levels of suffering increase to reach a certain point where people say, well, come on, there must be more to life than this. I went through that. I don't know if anyone else has gone through that. But that has to be a very individual thing. It's not like a society all stands up at once and says, there has to be more to life than this. It's a very individual thing. Personally, you go, well, come on, there has to be more than this. And you go on a personal journey of discovery. But the world turns as it must. And does our culture honour and respect its arahants? The Buddha says, I do not dispute with the world. The world disputes with me. He had no views. He looks closely and clearly at the way life really is, saw it for what it really is, and was at peace because he no longer craved for it to be different. But that's not indifference. There's that expression, seeing action in non-action and non-action in action. So when you see non-action in action, it's seeing that actually all the actions that people perform in order to try to resolve the problem of suffering is nothing at all. It's illusory action. It doesn't resolve anything at all. Because everything in life arises and passes away. Nothing endures. And that's very unsatisfactory, but that's reality. Seeing the action in non-action is the recognition that someone who is truly at peace, although it appears that they perform no action in the world, an arahant, an enlightened being, is the perfect counterweight for all that excess and greed and hatred and cruelty. They actually act in the most astonishing way, but it's not seen by the majority because the majority are so clouded in their vision. But actually, although appearing to do nothing, the enlightened being does everything. When somebody has thoroughly investigated their experience and they've let go of all their wrong ideas, wrong perceptions, and they've gone beyond the dualistic world and they see truly that there is no separation anyway, they're truly at peace, then it's possible to see life from so many angles, so many points of view. It's so easy to empathise, even within the most difficult situations. There's a wonderful series on the TV called The Hunt. I don't know if anyone's seen it. And it's all about predators. It's all about animals chasing other animals in order to eat them. And have you seen some of the footage of these incredible lions, predators, these machines, doing what comes naturally to them, doing what's neither right nor wrong, but just is. These wonderful beings performing these incredible feats of hunting and learning all these clever techniques as they go. It's the most astonishing thing. Now, is that right? Is it wrong? Should we go and say, lions should stop eating deer or whatever it is they eat? No, of course you don't. Because that's what life's like. That is life. And it's the possibility that you can actually observe all kinds of different angles, all kinds of different views, because you're not stymied, you're not stuck yourself in one particular way of seeing life. So it's an incredible freedom, because you have no views. All right.